I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of November, all things political this hour. And David Zwerdlich is our guest. David has been with us several times before. He's assistant editor of Outlook Post Everything at the Washington Post. We, of course, will start with the horror in Paris, the retaliation for the attacks, and the world asking, what do we do now? France responded by bombing the Syrian city of Raqqa on Sunday. And the president of France, François Hollande, has vowed to be unforgiving with the barbarians of the Islamic State after what happened in Paris. France conducting many airstrikes against the Islamic State in Iraq with some help from the United States. The president has reiterated that there will not be American boots on the ground. And of course, all of this is finding its way and may for some time into the presidential 2016 race. It was the opening conversation in the Democratic debate on Saturday night, and Republican candidates have been talking about the United States and what our role should be and whether or not we should close our borders to Syrian refugees. There's just an awful lot to discuss. Also, there is the possibility that France will ask for help from NATO under an attack on one is an attack on all. So in addition to the world dealing with this and how to fight the Islamic State, a transformation of the 2016 presidential election conversation, just a few of the things that we will be talking about. We will devote the entire second hour of our program today to the horrific attacks in Paris, preceded by the bombings in Beirut, preceded by a bomb which brought down a Russian plane. We'll get a better understanding of ISIS and how to combat this threat, this barbarian threat. Hour two of our show with three different guests. David, thank you so much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Hey, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, David. Oh, what a weekend, huh?
Yeah,
it's just
right. Really
hard, really hard. And really hard for everybody steps up and says, well, we should have been doing this, or it's a failure that we haven't been able to confront this group. But it really is going to be a situation that will require a world kind of involvement, won't it, to get rid of this kind of barbarism?
Yeah, it will. And I think it bears saying, right at the outset that, you know, it's important for us just to think about the tragedy in human terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's obviously we're going to talk about the politics, and a lot of the talk over the weekend and today is about the politics. But it really is just, you know, brutal to think of, you know, 129 people losing their lives, hundreds of people being wounded in attacks that, you know, regardless of where you stand on the political aisle, you know, are just, you know, in one light, completely senseless, completely, you know, devastating. And I just think that's important for us to say before we launch off into the politics. But on the politics, yeah, there are, as you mentioned at the top, Kathleen, there are a lot of people criticizing our current policy, and I think our current policy has to come under some scrutiny at this point because, you know, people do feel threatened. People in Western countries, France, obviously the focal point right now, but here in the United States. But what you heard President Obama saying today, and pushing back in a political sense, this isn't a policy response, but in a political sense, you know, he made this statement today where he said, look, and I'll quote him directly,
mm-hmm.
If folks want to, this is a quote from the president this morning in Turkey, if folks want to pop off and have opinions about what they think they would do, present a specific plan. Now, obviously, a lot of his critics are going to take that as petulance, but I think, and you know, had I been advising him, I may not have advised him to phrase it in quite those words, but I think he is presenting a legitimate pushback to his critics, in which he's saying, look, you know, what is the alternative plan to what we are doing now? The president has engaged in hundreds of airstrikes in the last year and a half in Syria and Iraq. Clearly, he has, you know, kind of very gradually and recently engaged our special forces over the last year. And there is, there are obviously counterterrorism efforts going on behind the scene. Drone strikes Friday, right before we got the Paris news, there was the news that reportedly at least one of our drone strikes had killed, you know, so-called jihadi John. But his critics keep saying, Kathleen, right, he's not doing enough. And I think the president's response is, well, what would you do? Because your listeners can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Senator Lindsey Graham is the only person currently running for president who has flatly stated that he would insert 10 or 20,000 ground troops into Iraq and Syria. Everyone else has just simply said, do more, without putting a lot of meat on the bones. And I think that's where we are in the debate right now.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that's fairly shocking is the nature of this attack and where they attacked and who they attacked. Just people were at a restaurant and people going to a music concert, and they hope to do much more damage, I'm sure, at the soccer stadium. It appeared to be something different in this front, that the president's words about containment, which he meant containing territory in Iraq and Syria. ISIS is not having as much territory, but they have the ability now to do these kinds of attacks that it didn't seem as though not only the United States, but France and other places were expecting. It's something different.
Say that last part again, Kathleen.
That nobody seemed to be expecting this kind of attack. That perhaps we all thought that there was a kind of containment going on, and now all of a sudden we're dealing with these kinds of horrific attacks, which could happen in many places. They happened in Beirut the day before. They happened in Paris. So the group has much more of a world presence right now.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and I'm sorry I missed that the first time around. So right. I mean, there are two things going on here, as you say, Kathleen. On the one hand, ISIS or ISIS affiliates, or however they're organized, where they're either inspiring or coordinating or franchising out attacks or directly planning and coordinating attacks. I think some of that intelligence is still kind of trickling into the news. But these, let's just call them broadly, these ISIS attacks, they have, as you say, more reach than people seem to think just a few days ago. And when you see, you know, authorities going out to Brussels, Belgium, to arrest people for an attack that took place in Paris, it clearly suggests a network across Europe and the Middle East and perhaps into this hemisphere. And these attacks clearly seem to strike at the heart of what we think of as the foundations of our free society. I this is not my thoughts, but I was reading this online today, and I think it's right that, you know, when you attack a sporting event, a nightclub, a restaurant, a sidewalk cafe, what you're saying is we are attacking your way of life. What ISIS is saying to Westerners is we are attacking your way of life. I was just, by, you know, pure coincidence, not anything related to my work, on vacation in Paris several weeks ago, and I was thinking about the fact that we spent a lot of time sitting at outdoor cafes.
Sure.
That's what people do there, and was very enjoyable, and it was like that's what you partake of when you're in that city or cities here in the United States as well. And to strike at that is to say we are making your way of life uncomfortable, I think, and I think that poses a real problem for us, and it's not clear to me that anyone has the precise answer on how to combat that.
Yeah, well, let's get political now. Do you think that this is going to consume the presidential discussion for 2016 for some time now?
I think at a minimum it's going to hurt the candidates who wanted to talk about domestic issues. On the Democratic side, I really think that the candidacy of Senator Sanders is focused on domestic issues, income inequality, health care, tax policy. He is trying to campaign for this idea that the middle class and the working class have been left out of the recovery, and his message is, look, I have policies that will reverse that trend, however rapidly or slowly. That is the thrust of his message. When the country is talking about terror attacks, something that Senator Sanders has not been as vocal on, I think that takes some of the steam out of his campaign. Similarly, on the Republican side, you have someone like Rand Paul, who really, you know, rose to political prominence in 2010 when the Tea Party was at its full-throatedness, you know, talking about the deficit and debt and taxation and reducing the size of government. But now that we've gotten back into a foreign policy, national security mindset in terms of our political discussion, someone like Rand Paul, his message just isn't resonating as well with voters. And this is reflected certainly in the case of Senator Paul in the polls. Senator Sanders is faring better in the polls, but there are fewer Democratic candidates.
Yeah, E.J. Dionne asked today, will a new post-Paris Syria seriousness knock back Donald Trump and Ben Carson?
I think it may over time. Look, Trump and Carson, and you know, I haven't been on your show in a while, so we haven't had a chance to chat about them in a non-terrorism framework.
Right.
I will say to your listeners, of all the presidential candidates on both sides, the only candidate I have personally one-on-one sat down face-to-face interviewed is Dr. Carson, so I'll get to him in a second. But as far as Donald Trump, you know, I was very critical of him when I was writing for The Root in 2011 because of the way he came after President Obama on the birth certificate issue. I have not written about him since then. My perspective on Donald Trump is, like the conventional wisdom, there is clearly something about the way he communicates, something about the way he's animated, something about the way he goes for the gut as opposed to some of the, you know, the policy specifics that appeals to voters. So it's not an accident that he's leading in the polls. On the other hand, as people start to get closer to actually casting votes in the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primaries, I do think that I'm not going to be one of these people that says Trump is fading. I don't think he's fading, but I do think it's going to be harder for him to have the sort of rise in the polls that he had from midsummer until about mid-fall, right? I think to increase support beyond people who have already said, yeah, I'm a Trump person, is going to be tougher for him now.
Yeah.
With regard to Carson, someone that I've written about a lot, someone who I have interviewed one-on-one, I don't know what is going to happen in the short term with his poll numbers, but having spoken to him directly, I feel comfortable saying to you, Kathleen, and saying to folks out there listening, I fundamentally find him to be not deep enough on some of these foreign policy issues to make a strong showing as the race wears on. And that is, I think, something that seems to be forming. If folks saw him on Fox News Sunday yesterday, Chris Wallace asked him very directly, you know, if you were going to address this ISIS situation, who would be your first call? And I think that answer was open for him to say, I would call General so-and-so, or or I would call, you know, insert name of European head of state, or insert name of leader of major Sunni Arab regional power. And instead his answer was he would call for, quote, all of the Arab states to respond to this. Now, that's not necessarily a disqualifying answer, but that's an answer that anyone who reads the news could probably give, not someone who is sort of putting themselves out there as a potential future commander-in-chief. When I interviewed Dr. Carson in January, and that interview is also now, of course, I'm at the Post now, but I was still at the Root at the time, he and I circled around and around on this question of whether or not his lack of political experience was a factor. And he had this supreme and, I think, sincere confidence that the fact that he didn't have political experience would be overcome by the fact that he's a very, very intellectually, practiced person, that he is a person who thinks deeply, that he has managed people in the course of being a brain surgeon and in the course of being the head of the pediatric neurosurgery department at Johns Hopkins. His statement to me, and this is almost verbatim, was, you know, it would be a lot harder for a governor or senator to learn how to do my job, meaning brain surgeon, than it would be for me as a brain surgeon to learn how to do their job, which, as it goes, is not necessarily untrue. The problem is that Governor Bush, Governor Christie, Senator Paul, Senator Cruz, they're not trying to be brain surgeons, right? I mean, that's the fundamental problem.
Right.
They're career politicians who are continuing to try and be career politicians. He is a brain surgeon and undoubtedly an accomplished one, trying to become a politician in a world that requires a certain amount of political experience and ability to move the levers of government. In my view, he doesn't quite have it.
Yeah, and certainly requires an understanding of what's happening in this so volatile part of the world that seems to be threatening many of us. When he's talking about, well, you know, China's involved in Syria, at the last Republican presidential debate, you had to scratch your head and say, where did that come from?
Yeah, no, I mean, his answers come off, again, my subjective opinion, again, but having talked to him one-on-one, his answers in that case that you mentioned from the debate and in my conversation with him come off as someone who has done sort of a boning up out of briefing books of, you know, on Ukraine, on the Middle East, on NATO, on issues like, you know, missile defense in Eastern Europe. He's boned up out of briefing books. He has talked to experts and kind of formed this real-time view of how these policy questions should be addressed. But his answers, in my view, again, don't reflect someone who has spent a good chunk of his life thinking about foreign policy, mm-hmm. thinking about tax policy. If I can flip it from foreign policy just to illustrate the point, when I asked him in my interview with him what he would cut, right? Republicans are for cutting the size of government, typically. He really declined to give me an answer. He, you know, most candidates, even at the state legislative level or the congressional level, would say, I'm going to do a 10% cut across the board, or I'd get rid of the Department of Education, or, you know, if I am elected, everything will be subject to review. But his answer was along the lines of, well, as people, believe it or not, he said to me, as people leave the departments, we will actually reduce the expense of federal departments through attrition by not backfilling those positions. Now, I think his position has evolved since then, but even if that's not his position any longer, the idea that someone, you know, a month or two away from declaring a presidential candidacy that would give an answer like that strikes me again as someone who, although quite a brilliant neurosurgeon, has not spent a lot of time thinking through the complex policy issues that rise to the level of the President of the United States.
The last debate was Saturday night. That's a weird time to have a presidential debate. Why are the Democrats having these debates at these times when people are usually doing other things? We'll talk about the Democratic debate. David mentioned some of the Democratic response. They're also, Hillary Clinton appeared to be on the defense when she was, it was brought up where money was coming from campaigns, the amount of money that she was getting from Wall Street, and her response, which a lot of people were upset about, what campaign donations from big banks had to do with New York's recovery from 9/11. We'll talk about her response to that and whether she appeared to be on the defensive or, as others have said, is this event, horrendous event, and continuing concern about ISIS, something that will serve her well in her candidacy because she has experience as being Secretary of State. So, we have a lot to talk about this hour. David Zwerdlich is our guest. David is now the assistant editor of Outlook Post Everything at the Washington Post, and we're welcoming your phone calls. How does what happened in Paris, what happened in Beirut, the downing of the Russian airliner, change the presidential debate? Does it give candidates who seem to have more experience with foreign affairs an edge in this debate? What do you think about how this changes politics? The second hour of our show, we'll talk about the horrendous attacks in Paris and how we respond to them as a world. Here's our phone number. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. I'm interested in hearing from those of you who did see the debate on Saturday night. You spent your Saturday night being political and informing yourself and what you thought of that. All right, we have a ton of phone calls coming in for David. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Zwerdlich is our guest this hour, and we go to phone calls now, starting with Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I'm very disappointed about what's happened in Paris. I was there in 1999, and I'm pretty sure the band I was with played at that theater. And it's stunning how close these things hit to home. But I want to come back to our response to this. The president of France said, we will show no mercy. Now, this is what we apparently hate about these Islamic so-called terrorists, is that they show no mercy. Why would we want to copy them in any way. And then, Kathleen, you just used the word barbarism. Now, we have killed thousands of innocent people in Arab countries over the last 12 to 15 years with drone bombing, and we call that collateral damage. We don't see any demonstrations on the streets here for the innocents that are being killed there. Why must we fight this in a way, you know, like when we fought the Nazis, did we copy the Nazis' techniques of locking up people and starving and gassing people and burning thousands of soldiers at one time in a barn? I remember that discussion on public radio. We did not do that. Now, we did do some other things like firebomb Dresden. We did bomb.
All right, Ray, what do you think we should do?
We should stand true to what we believe is right in this world. And when we arrest terrorists, they should be treated as human beings. And when they are proven to be guilty, then we need to have that discussion. But we shouldn't be torturing. We shouldn't be doing drone bombing, because all we are doing is making recruits. Every time we...
Okay, thank you, Ray. David, your response.
So I do understand the sentiment where that Ray is. I think I understand Ray to be offering, but here I think is the challenge at a minimum, and this is not to dismiss the point that Ray's making, is that, you know, talking about something like Dresden as a comparator is tough, because wherever anyone stands on the bombing of Dresden, we were in a war, the United States, against Germany at the time. This was two world powers in a war against each other. And now we're talking about this asymmetrical situation where if there is, in fact, a war, and many would describe this as a war, and I don't want to take a side on that particular question at the moment, that it is against the Islamic State, which controls territory and has an ideology and has leadership and so forth, but is not a recognized country in any sense that we normally conceive of it. So I think that it's a tough analogy. To Ray's other point about the United States, certainly, and I think this is something that you would hear the President of the United States say, is the United States certainly has made mistakes over time. You know, I don't want to be an apologist for this idea that anybody's death would be collateral damage, but I do think that we're in a stage now where, unfortunately, the challenge we face, right, and this is, again, you know, my own subjective opinion, is that, you know, in 2008, it seems to me that by electing President Obama, someone who had explicitly and from the beginning opposed the Iraq war, the body politic of the United States was saying to the world, among other things, we'd like to turn the page on the Iraq war and that we want to go in a different direction. The unfortunate challenge of that is that from the perspective, I would say, of someone who is, actively somewhere saying that the United States is actively oppressing them in their country. Let's just say it's someone who is, in ISIS, although I don't want to just narrow this to ISIS, the problem with that is that whether we voted for Obama or whether we voted for Bush or whoever we elect next time, it's unlikely that they make that differentiation in their own mind. We would like to think we've turned the page, and I don't think, you know, it's realistic to expect that other people in every part of the world are thinking that we turned the page. This is my view, that reasonable minds can differ on this point, but I do understand what Ray is saying.
And David, just before we go on to another call, can you make a moral comparison between drone strikes and ISIS attacks in Paris? Is there an equivalency here?
Well, so this is part and parcel of that same point. If you look at a drone strike, again, and I want to be really clear with your listeners that this is my view. I don't think there is only one way to look at this. If you look at a drone strike in a vacuum and you say a drone strike, we have actionable intelligence, the United States has actionable intelligence, that there are known terrorists in a community or at a, you know, we always have the example of a wedding or a family
right.
gathering, and the terrorists are killed, but other innocents are killed in that drone strike, I would not want to make the argument that it's okay to have these people thought of simply as collateral damage, right? They are human beings who would be killed and otherwise perhaps not involved in terror. On the other hand, if you say the choice for the President of the United States as Commander-in-Chief, and the Commander-in-Chief has a different job than you and me, is to have a quote-unquote light footprint in the Middle East and do targeted drone strikes on actionable intelligence, as opposed to having tens of thousands of troops, let's say, in Iraq. I'm sure the Obama administration would make the argument, maybe not in these words, that they're trying to have a lighter footprint. In other words, they can't extricate themselves completely from fighting in the Middle East, but that the Obama administration policy, in my view, has been, we're going to do it with drones, we're going to do it with small groups of special forces, and not occupy these countries and wage day-to-day war on the ground.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Ray. Let's go to Alex in Milwaukee. Hi, Alex.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. I just have a quick couple questions. Number one, does our lack of commitment in the Middle East concerning ISIS kind of reflect a broader kind of isolationist tendency that maybe the United States is kind of going back into? And number two, how responsible do you think we are for creating the power vacuum that has arisen once we left Iraq and Afghanistan?
David.
Sure, and I'm sorry, the caller's name was John, is that right?
Alex.
Alex, I'm sorry, Alex. So, Alex, I think those are two very good specific questions, right? I mean, I think those cut to the heart of the matter in a way that's more these broader, like, do something or not do something questions don't. So I appreciate that. And let me take the power vacuum question first. I think now it could be reasonably argued that the critics, like, say, Senator John McCain being the most visible, who said several years ago that we should not remove all of our combat troops from Iraq, that things might have gone differently. That's not necessarily my view, but I think it would be reasonable to say, look, by leaving Iraq when we did at the end of 2011, even though it was done according to the status of forces agreement that expired, that it did leave the opportunity for the Islamic State to essentially fester and grow, or whatever, you know, colorful language people use, metastasize. And that's a legitimate criticism. It's hard to prove a negative or a counterfactual, but that is a possibility. But I wouldn't describe it, though, this is to your second point, your first point, I wouldn't describe it as a lack of commitment. I mean, again, one thing that I think gets overlooked in this debate, and if I may sort of say this is something that I think people have not thought about in regard to the way the Obama administration has approached things. In recent days, administration critics have given a lot of credit to French President Hollande and to British Prime Minister Cameron for making these very full-throated statements about how this violence will not stand, Europe will defend itself, NATO will defend itself, and praised them and said, how can a socialist president of France and a, you know, prime minister of the UK speak more tough about terrorism than the president of the United States? Except it's the president of the United States who has done the overwhelming number of air sorties and bombing runs against the Islamic State in Syria. I mean, France and Britain and our other NATO allies, and it's not a criticism of them, have done just the tiniest fraction of all the NATO airstrikes in the region. So if someone wants a more robust policy, either from our allies or from us or from the Sunni Arab regional powers, they first have to look at it and say, the war, even if the war is not being fought aggressively enough, it's being fought almost all by the United States right now.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of, and he's brought this up before, and others have said this, Senator Bernie Sanders, when we talk with our caller about creating a power vacuum, Sanders indicated, and many would agree with him, that we made a huge historical mistake in invading Iraq in the first place and creating a situation that created serious unrest in the whole region.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing, Kathleen. I mean, there are so many factors at play here, and you know, I am, as you know, and I love coming on your show and talking about the politics of this stuff. I and you know, your listeners that have heard me before know this, but just to remind you, know, I'm not a news reporter, right? I'm an opinion journalist and now an opinion editor. You know, I think a lot about the politics of this stuff. In terms of the expertise involved in what is going on the ground in the Middle East, you know, I'm learning some of this stuff as it comes in as well, just as your listeners are. You know, we have foreign policy experts and frontline reporters at the Post here who are really digging into this to try and find out what specifically is going on. But I think one thing in terms of the instability is that you do have this gap between what people want to see happen and what people are willing to make happen. So in other words, when you see President Obama say, you know, in spite of Paris, we stand with our allies, but we may or may not get more militarily involved, you know, what it looks like is, oh, you know, he's unwilling to act. But I think there's another way to look at it, where it's like, you know, he's looking at Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt,
right.
Jordan, et cetera,
right.
and saying, well, wait, the President of the United States is not holding the regional Sunni powers mm-hmm. from getting involved. They have militaries, they have planes, they have tanks, mm-hmm. they have soldiers. And so I think the unspoken question underneath all this is sort of a thing where even though President Obama might not say it like this, is, wait, if a Saudi soldier isn't going to die in Syria, why is a United States soldier going
yeah.
to die in Syria? And I think that's one question that hasn't yet been answered. It's a little different if you're President Hollande right now and you've had the Charlie Hebdo attacks at the beginning of the year and now the attacks from Friday.
Right.
You sort of have to get a more aggressive posture and get on the balls of your feet militarily because your public is simply demanding it.
Yeah. And it's such a legitimate question. Talk about diplomacy. Why isn't Saudi Arabia involved in this? You know, and indications are that, you know, there is money that's flowing from those in Saudi Arabia to terrorist organizations to keep themselves in power. And I think that's a legitimate question to find out how extensive that is and what it is you can do diplomatically to persuade countries like Saudi Arabia to step up.
Well, that to me is the, if I may use the old expression, the $64,000 question, Kathleen, right? In other words, you know, there's one school of thought that says the U.S. has to lead. There's another school of thought that says the U.S. has to support the efforts of these countries. But either way, again, right, there's nothing prohibiting the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, which is the Sunni Arab monarchies led by Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
or Turkey, which is not Arab but is Sunni, is a NATO country, has a huge military, and borders Syria. There's nothing stopping them from getting involved, or at least up until the point when Russia put its troops in there. And these countries are not aggressively involving themselves militarily. It's as if they're waiting for the United States to take action. And I do think that despite the criticism, again, I don't want to make this too Obama-centric, but despite the criticism that he continues to get and will continue to get by his critics, I do think that the president's stance up till now has been, look, we can support the fight. We have intelligence capabilities. We have submarines. We have, intercontinental ballistic missiles that other countries don't have. But every country has troops. Why should
right.
it be our
right.
troops? And I think that's right. the question that remains unanswered.
Oh, there's so much on so many levels to all of this, isn't there? Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really liked your last question, and I agree with you about that. But my question is a little different, and with regards to the politics and who we should vote for. After the Benghazi attack, we were told that this was due to a video, and it turns out that they knew that it was a terrorist attack from the beginning, and we were basically lied to. We were told that ISIS was being contained, and now we have this attack. It shows that they're not being contained. Who are we to believe? And how do we find out who we should vote for to lead us through this troubling time? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Charlie.
Yeah, so, Charlie, I think that's an excellent question. And, again, I realize that as we go further and further into this, I keep starting my answers by trying to reinterpret whatever message is coming out of the Obama administration. But I do think that the president's Good Morning America interview on Friday, before we learned about the Paris attacks, it struck me, if you read the whole quote in context, that he was saying that they have been contained, ISIS has been contained, quote-unquote, geographically in Syria and Iraq, not saying that they had no potential to attack outside of the borders of Syria and Iraq. That being said, it was an unwise statement to make on the part of the president, because he could have easily just said to, I think it was George Stephanopoulos, he could have easily just said, hey, we got Jihadi John, but the fight
right.
isn't over.
Right.
And that would have been a more realistic statement than saying we've contained them, because I don't think anybody believes they've been contained. To the point of Clinton, no question. Look, I don't think Republicans have been able to corner her on the politics. But out of those hearings a few weeks ago and out of the emails, Charlie is right. There were emails that showed that Secretary Clinton was saying one thing privately and something slightly different publicly. What I'll leave it to your listeners, Kathleen, to decide what they make of that. But, you know, when, you know, there's no sugarcoating that. What was said publicly was, hey, you know, we're looking at the video, and they were trying to analogize the Libya situation to what was going on at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. When, in fact, in those emails just within the first 24 hours, it clearly seemed to be that they at least were entertaining. I'm not saying they were sure. They were entertaining. They, meaning the State Department and Secretary Clinton, were entertaining the idea that it was a coordinated planned terrorist attack. That being said, in my view, again, the issue has more to do, less to do with what happened in the immediate frenzy of the Libya attacks, and more on the question of, you know, why weren't more preparations put in place? I do think that, again, you know, let's pause for a moment and think about the tragedy of four Americans losing their lives in Benghazi, and on the other hand, understanding that a U.S. consulate in a country in whose civil war we had just intervened in the Sunni Arab Muslim world, in a situation where there was not a stable government, in a situation where all sides acknowledge that that consulate actually was mostly a CIA station, you know, you would like to think that there, some thought would have been put, or more thought, I should say, had been put into what precautions should be taken if that kind of attack took place. And, you know, I don't think we're done unraveling yet.
Let's talk about refugees, Syrian refugees, who many of whom are trying to land, have left and left everything at home to escape horrible violence. Now we have, and it's primarily a Republican response in this country to block Syrian refugees from coming to America. States are saying they will not allow Syrian refugees, and obviously this is going to create even more chaos in Europe. Because, I mean, we don't know what the truth is here exactly, but there was a Syrian passport near one of the attackers, which matched one used by a refugee who had entered Europe through Greece, but we don't know if it was staged or if it was real or what. But the response, don't let anybody in. Mike Huckabee is saying we should deny entry to travelers from countries with a strong presence of the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, this is tough, and I think it's unfortunate. I think this, look, regardless again of where folks, including your listeners, Kathleen, come down on the issue of whether or not we, the United States, should accept a large number of refugees from Syria, I think that this is the wrong way to go about having that debate. If the people of the United States send the message to the leaders of the United States that we don't want to accept Syrian refugees, okay, let's have that debate. But the idea that a state is going to unilaterally, say to the rest of the states or say to the federal government, you know, we're gonna stop people at the border of our state, strikes me as, at a minimum, the wrong way to go about the debate. On the one hand, I've heard arguments already that this is, that the states don't have the constitutional right to do that. That may be true. Even if they did have the constitutional right to do that, I mean, we're really getting into this further polarization of our politics when, state governors are sort of playing the red-blue, divide and saying, look, you know, we don't want anything to do with these refugees. You know, if there's a way to bring refugees here and to somehow safely screen them to try and, the best we can, weed out potential, people who are sort of, for lack of a better term, sneaking in for nefarious purposes, then again, that's the debate we should be having, not saying, you know, like, oh, Michigan is a Syrian refugee free zone or Arkansas or whatever. I mean, that I think is just going to, devolve into scapegoating and into sort of the lowest common denominator of our political process, that reasonable minds can differ on whether we can afford to bring in 10 or 20 or 65,000 or whatever the proposals are of Syrian refugees. But this sort of state by state, like the race by these governors to say, not in my backyard, mm-hmm. I think is unproductive at a minimum.
David Zwerdlich is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. He's an assistant editor of Outlook Post Everything at the Washington Post. post, and we're welcoming your phone calls. We'll get to many more in just a few seconds here. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where if we don't get to you on the air, and if you can join us on Facebook, we're looking at the political ramifications in, well, blending that with all that's happened with the attacks in Paris and Beirut and the downing of the Russian airliner and ISIS making a very strong statement, although I'm not sure what the statement is, with all of these horrendous attacks in the past month. So we would love to know what you think about all of it. So leave your messages there if we can't get to you on the air, but we will get to many more of you on the air in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, Kesser is our next caller for you, David Zwerdlich. Kesser in Germantown. Hi. Hello? All right, well, call back. I don't know where you are. Let's go next to Mike in Plymouth. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. First of all, I think we're trying to militarily solve a problem with ISIS that is not a military issue. It's a theological and a spiritual issue. And I think what we need to do is take the approach that these suicide bombers believe that they're martyrs and they're going to heaven, and nobody's used the word cowards in any of the newscasts, you know, inhumane and whatever. If you start appealing to the male ego and tell people who are bullies and who are mass murderers that they are cowards and that, you know, they should be ashamed of themselves, that has an effect on their recruiting. It has an effect on the psychology. And unless we start changing the language to make the world shame these people into realizing that they are cowards, we're not going to succeed with ICM bombs and gunboats and everything else, because it's not a military war, it's a psychological war.
Interesting comment, David.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting comment, Mike. And I think it's good to sort of try and look at what are solutions as opposed to just sort of perseverating on the problem. I'm not sure I totally agree with that way of looking at the solution, and here's why. First of all, I sort of resist the idea that you can limit the problem of ISIS and of terror to one factor, right? It is not just religion. It is not just economics. It's not just a clash of East and West. It is not just, a raw struggle for power. It is kind of all of these things wrapped up together, and it's a question of where are the pressure points where one side or the other can exert its will. I think that in this situation, you know, even though in our political leadership, everywhere from George W. Bush across the aisle to President Obama, both Republicans and Democrats have pushed this notion that, look, we're not at war with Islam, and that a lot, you hear them say this, you hear a lot of moderate Muslims say, you know, that this is not a true representation of Islam. And I would subscribe to that view. On the other hand, though, there are people in ISIS who are Muslims, who live in the Muslim world, who do believe that what they're doing is a true representation of Islam. I'm not a theologian, so I can't, you know, say for you definitively what is and isn't, but I think I can say definitively that there are people in ISIS who do think they are following, their religious precepts by, you know, waging this war. Again, I'm, you know, doing the word war in quotes, but, you know, again, it's a war in one form or another. So the idea then of calling them cowards and shaming them out of doing this, if they think their cause is righteous, even if we, from our Western point of view, can see sort of clearly how unrighteous it is, I'm not sure that's totally going to work in this case. But I do see where Mike is coming from.
Yeah, thank you very much. Equally interesting response, David. Mike, thanks for the call. We go to John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hi. Hello. I'd like to get back to the Trump-Carson issue. I'm looking for an opinion. I think that, you know, they're going to stay reasonably steady in the polls. I don't believe that their constituents, are that far apart on the issue. So if that were to be true, then I just wonder who is going to pop up from the rest of the candidates to be that person that gets up to that 17, 18, 20, 21% range with, you know, 40% of it currently anyway, pretty much taken up, even up or down by 3 points by both Trump and Carson.
Yeah, you know, Kathleen, and I tend to think this thing has not sorted itself out yet. I agree with the car, and I'm sorry, car, I didn't catch your name, but
John.
So, John, I agree that Trump and Carson are not going to fade, and I think we'll have, at least have to get to the Iowa caucuses at the early part of next year before we know what's really going to shake out on the Republican side. There are still so many candidates. But I am one who has resisted this idea that Bush is disintegrating or that you know, some of the other more mainstream candidates are disintegrating. Look, I think Bush still has a chance. I think Senator Rubio has, you know, emerged as an alternative on the Republican quote-unquote establishment side. I think Senator Cruz, although I don't think he'd fare well in a general election, still is strong in the Republican primary. With a few exceptions, I don't think that the Republican race has really, other than, you know, ironically, okay, we're in Wisconsin right now. Governor Walker made an early decision to get out, and even though he was one of the people that was touted as an early favorite, I go back to when he announced, he gave a very strong announcement speech, and then he just couldn't translate it on the trail or in the debates. But the people who have hung in here this long, at least the top 8 or 9 folks, I don't see them shaking out, at least until we get through a primary or two. I just wanted to add one other thing, and that would be that, you know, if you're someone like Jeb Bush, who's been now counted out by the conventional wisdom over the last 2 or 3 weeks, he just doesn't have a lot of incentive to get out of the race because he's got over $100 million in a super PAC.
Ooh, does he have that much money? Oh, my.
I mean, obviously, a super PAC is not the same as having it in his campaign, but and this is not my insight. This is something that I've heard others say, but I think it's true, is that campaigns tend to fizzle when they can't raise money or when they run out of money, not just when they have a dip in the polls or when their candidate is sort of fumbling on the stump. I will say, and I've said this is my one sort of, you know, insight that I have not heard a lot of other people say. I hope it's an insight. Is that, you never
it
know.
Is, David,
it might
it
be
is.
Foolishness.
No.
No, and that is that regardless of what side of the political aisle you were on in 2012, it's my view that each party had its best candidate forward. The Democrats had President Obama forward. The Republicans had Governor Romney forward. Whatever people thought of either of them individually, it strikes me that those were the two best, those were the two best candidates to go head to head. In 2016, it's not clear to me yet that either or both parties will have its strongest, most broadest tent, big tent candidate forward come next November. And I think that's the difference between this election and the last one.
All right, let's try to quickly get to a couple more calls. We're almost out of time. Kesser in Germantown. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call again. I'm a very, very, very liberal Muslim, and I've lived in this country for 30 years. And what I see, what happened in Paris, is beyond imagination. It makes me sad and ashamed that people who are of the same belief that I am are capable of doing something. But let me also talk about why this happened in Paris. Over 100 people were killed in Lebanon. Nothing. I hardly hear about it. It looks like every Dick, Tom, and Harry from CNN has moved to Paris to cover that tragedy, but there's not a word, hardly anything about the people. Does it make me feel, or should I believe that the white Christian people are more, Western people are more important than brown Muslims?
Oh, thank you very much. There have been a lot of complaints about that. Why not much focus on Lebanon? David.
Yeah, no, I think Kesser brings up a great point. So again, with what I think should be obvious but isn't always obvious, Kathleen, is that whenever innocent people die, we're talking about innocent people and innocent human beings, and human life should be equally valued. That being said, I do think there is a tendency here, and even if it's not right in a pure moral sense, I think it goes to human nature, that we in the West see Parisians as like us. Mm-hmm. They're Westerners. Paris is their New York, right? It is, a city where many Americans visit, where many Americans have memories of traveling there. And so it's easier to identify with, again, maybe not in the purest moral sense, but just in the human mm-hmm. sense, easier to identify with this attack that you could think it could happen in my city here in a way that's harder for people to imagine in Lebanon.
Thank you, David. Yeah. We're out of time. Thank you so much.
Kathleen.
No, thank you. Don't be sorry. Thank you.
Okay.
David's word, we always like having him with us. He's now assistant editor of Outlook Post Everything at the Washington Post. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show and for his on-air production as well. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Please stay with us. We will talk about the attacks in Paris. How do we fight ISIS right after the news?